The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and I'm so glad you could join me for today's show. This was a big week in the world of philanthropy. The MacArthur Foundation announced its four finalists of its 100 and change competition, where the winner will be awarded $100 million to help solve one of the world's most complex social problems. We will play two of the interviews of the finalists tonight, and then the other two in the weeks ahead. And those other two would be Catholic Relief Services, Changing How Society Cares for Children in Orphanages, and Harvest Plus, Eliminating Hidden Hunger in Africa by Fortifying Staple Crops. But tonight, you will hear from Rebecca Cordom Richards, the director of Rice University's 360-degree Institute for Global Health, and she will speak to us about their efforts to improve newborn survival in Africa.
Malawi actually has the highest rate of preterm births in the world. 18% of babies are born prematurely there. And so, you know, in some ways, it's really ironic that the place that has the least ability to deal with the challenges of prematurity suffers one of the highest prematurity rates in the world.
And then a tag team entry to educate children displaced by conflict and persecution. And joining us will be Sherry Weston, Executive Vice President of Global Impact and Philanthropy at Sesame Workshop, and Sarah Smith, Senior Director of Education at the International Rescue Committee. And she will provide some context as to why this educational initiative is so vitally needed.
It's quite shocking. I think this is one of the most unbelievable statistics. And on average, a refugee stays a refugee for 17 years, and somebody who's been displaced in their country for 25 years. So this is a long-term problem.
And we'll have time for our Better Than Most segment from our Corporate Culture series to round out the hour. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, September 24th. Describing the results as disappointing, Harvard University reported on Tuesday that its $37 billion endowment earned just 8.1% for its most recent fiscal year. The return trails a mean one-year return of 12.7% by more than 400 institutions tracked by Cambridge Associates. Jasper Johns, America's most acclaimed living artist, received approval last week to turn his 170-acre property in Sharon, Connecticut, into an artist retreat after he dies. Johns is 87 years old. According to the Millennial Impact Report, that cohort identified civil rights and racial discrimination as their number one social issue of concern. Tied for second were healthcare, along with job creation and employment. An estimated 40.3 million men, women, and children around the globe are victims of modern slavery, this according to a report by the 8.7 Alliance. And finally, Washington, D.C.'s Capital Area Food Bank, one of the biggest in the country, has reduced the junk food that it supplies its 444 nonprofit partners, including soup kitchens and food pantries, by a whopping 84%. Congratulations to them. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with the first of the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and change finalists right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Reached the midpoint of featuring the 8 semifinalists of the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change competition. And tonight it is a great pleasure to have with us Dr. Rebecca Richards-Cordom, the founder and co-director of Rice University's 360-degree Institute for Global Health. Good evening, Rebecca, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you so much.
Your life was changed forever. Back in 2006, when you walked into a two-room ward at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital in Malawi, what did you see there, Rebecca?
It was such a life-changing moment for me to walk into that neonatal unit. And I was struck by, first, just the number of babies that were in a very tiny space. There were probably 50 babies, many of them sharing beds because they didn't have enough bed space for each baby to have its own bed. And there were just a few nurses, all of whom were really busy trying to take care of babies that were quite ill. But as an engineer, the other thing that really struck me was the lack of technology. You know, when you walk into a neonatal intensive care unit in the United States, it is just full of big pieces of equipment. And that equipment has made a huge improvement in rates of survival, especially for babies who are born too soon or who are born small. And in this neonatal unit in Malawi, there was none of that equipment there. You know, I just, the contrast of all of that, it made such an impression. And I think it made an impression both for me as a mom and for me as an engineer.
Mm-hmm. And I think what was even more distressing is that when you walk down the hall of that very same facility, you came across a room commonly known as the equipment graveyard. What was that?
Yeah, so we walked just down the hall and into a room that was full of equipment that had been donated by people like me in places like Houston, hoping to improve care in the newborn ward there. And unfortunately, what happened when that equipment met the harsh environmental conditions at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital, it didn't last very long. Mm. So a line voltage spike would fry one of the circuit cards, or the dust in the environment would clog a filter in the machine. And so, you know, what you find is that things that are designed to work in high resource settings often fail very quickly when they get to low resource settings. In fact, in that room, I remember we counted there were 82 broken oxygen concentrators. Hmm. And if any one of those oxygen concentrators had been working, you know, it could have been saving the lives of babies in that neonatal unit.
Are a lot of these babies born prematurely in Malawi?
Malawi actually has the highest rate of preterm birth in the world. 18% of babies are born prematurely there. And so, you know, in some ways, it's really ironic that the place that has the least ability to deal with the challenges of prematurity suffers one of the highest prematurity rates in the world.
Yeah, that's pretty striking. Well, when a baby is born prematurely, their lungs are not fully developed, so they have trouble breathing. What device do we use here in the United States to address that, and what did you and your team of students at Rice 360 set out to create?
Yeah, so one of our team members is a wonderful pediatrician named Liz Molyneux, who's worked in Malawi at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital since the early 1970s. And she explained to us that about half of babies that are born prematurely, they struggle to breathe because their lungs are immature. And, you know, I have to tell you that it is just heartbreaking to watch one of these babies struggle to breathe. You know, you can see their chest, it moves in and it moves out. They call it indrawing, and you can just see the effort to breathe. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, in the early 1970s, there was a technology developed called CPAP. It stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure, and it's a really simple idea. So the reason that these babies struggle to breathe is that their lungs lack a protein called surfactant that reduces surface tension. And the analogy that I like to use is, think about blowing up a balloon. You know how when you blow up a balloon, you put those first few puffs of air in, it's really hard to get it open?
Sure is.
That's what every breast is like for those little babies, because they don't have this protein that reduces the surface tension. And so what CPAP does is you just take a soft set of rubber prongs and you put it in the baby's nose, and then you blow in a mix of air and oxygen at constant pressure. And what that does is it keeps their lungs inflated. It like keeps the balloon inflated. And so the subsequent puffs of air, it's much easier to get them in the balloon. That's what CPAP does for babies, is it just reduces that work of breathing. And typically it just takes them about a week or maybe 10 days. Mm-hmm. until their body starts to make enough surfactant and they don't need treatment with CPAP anymore. And literally, it can be the difference between life and death. When CPAP was introduced in the United States back in the early 70s, what we saw was that rates of survival went from 25% to 70%.
Wow, that's dramatic.
Yeah, and you know, in fact, President Kennedy and his wife had a baby who was born prematurely right about at that time, and that baby was not treated with CPAP, and the baby did not survive. And, you know, we were at a time when we were making a huge investment in strengthening newborn care and neonatal intensive care in our country. And it really turned the tide on improving newborn survival here. Malawi has been left out of that.
So the challenge that you faced is to create a CPAP device that would be rugged and robust enough to survive in Malawi and also be affordable. How did you go about doing that?
Well, so we talked to Liz Molyneux about what she thought was needed. And she showed us actually a CPAP machine that she had invented herself. Even though she's a pediatrician, she's secretly an engineer at heart, we think. So she took a vacuum pump that she found and she reverse engineered it so that instead of creating a vacuum, it served as a flow driver. But that actually caused the pump to overheat. And so she set up a kitchen fan to blow on the pump so that it wouldn't overheat. And she made her own CPAP machine. And she said, the nurses are a little afraid of it. And when I saw it, I could see why. It was kind of a scary looking machine. But, you know, it really showed us how necessary that technology was. So my colleague Maria Oden and I came back. And at that time, Maria was teaching our capstone senior design course. And so she assigned in the fall of 2009 a team of senior bioengineering students to come up with a CPAP machine that could be used in Malawi. And that team, they worked over the course of a whole year, and they had a brilliant idea, which was they thought to themselves, what can we use to deliver flow that's cheap and that will never break? And their aha moment was at Petco, an aquarium pump.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so they took two $25 aquarium pumps and they put it in a little plastic shoebox that they bought at Target, and they made a CPAP device. And they were able to take it over to Texas Children's Hospital right across the street from us here in Houston. And they compared the flow and the pressure that their system delivered to the $8,000 CPAP machines that are used to treat babies here. And they showed that their device delivered equivalent flow and pressure, and it only cost $160 to make.
Mighty impressive.
Yeah, so they took it to Malawi. One of the student inventors traveled to Malawi the summer after she graduated, and I got to see her there when she was demonstrating it to all of the nurses that work in that very same neonatal unit that I first went to in 2006. And these nurses, they told her everything that was wrong with her device. They said some of the tubes go in the front side, some of the tubes go out the back side. It's too confusing. They said, we want a light so that we know that if it's plugged into an outlet that the power is actually getting delivered. They said, you have made a device that works on a 110 volt outlet. That's not what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And that little step down transformer that you put on, it's going to walk away and then we're going to fry the pumps. But they said, we'd really like to keep it and start using it.
Yeah.
So what we did, the student, Jocelyn Brown, she came back to Rice, and she worked over the course of a year to make all of the changes that the nurses told her were necessary. And with that, we were able to get a grant from USAID to actually do a clinical evaluation of the CPAP technology. And so we compared it to the use of just low-pressure oxygen, which at the time was all that was available in Malawi to treat preterm babies that had respiratory distress. And Jocelyn was able to show that survival went from 25 to 65% for those preterm babies that were treated with her invention.
Now, as the students like Jocelyn and her fellow students turn out these remarkable innovations, they still have a ways to go, Rebecca, before they can reach the commercial marketplace. And you have found an indispensable partner in that effort. Who are they and what role are they playing?
So we have been working with a commercial partner called Third Stone Design, and they are absolutely an essential part of our team in helping us go from really what is a student prototype to what we call a clinic-ready evaluation unit that we can actually safely introduce in the clinic to evaluate its performance and understand what improvements are needed, and then actually turn it into a medical product, which has gone through international regulatory approval and can actually be sold to, you know, begin improving care on a much wider scale.
Mm-hmm. And how many babies have received treatment from this CPAP device that you guys created?
So CPAP has been implemented by our program countrywide all across Malawi. And that was done with grant funding from USAID. And so when you go into any government, district, or central hospital all across the country, you will find preterm babies are able, if they need it, to receive treatment with CPAP. We've treated over 2,200 babies in Malawi with this technology. But Third Stone has been now selling the device throughout low-resource settings. And without any grant support, this device is now being used to save newborn lives in 26 countries. They have over 500 CPAP devices that have been delivered and are being used throughout the world.
What an uplifting story. Now, how do we know, Rebecca, that this device is not going to end up in the equipment graveyard with so many others?
Yeah, so we have been tracking the performance of the CPAP technology as we've rolled this out across Malawi. And when we deliver the CPAP machines, we also deliver oxygen concentrators at the same time. We have been supplying the model of oxygen concentrator, which is recommended by the WHO. So this is supposed to be the best model for a low-resource setting. And what we found as we've rolled these out is that we have not seen any failures of the Pumani CPAP devices that couldn't be repaired locally. In contrast, what we found with those oxygen concentrators is that 63% of them have failed. And the mean time to failure is 413 days.
Oh, man.
So, it's a very expensive piece of equipment, just isn't lasting.
Mm-hmm. Well, with CPAP, in a sense, as your proof of concept, you began looking at other things that babies are dying from in Africa. So in addition to respiratory distress, what are some of those things, Rebecca?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. What we found as we began rolling CPAP out across Malawi, because we found that the newborn units were missing many technologies, not just technologies to help babies breathe. And one of the most important things they were missing is tools to help keep babies warm. And we found that if babies were being treated for their respiratory difficulties, if they weren't warm, the outcomes weren't as good. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense.
Sure does.
If you don't treat all of the needs of these babies, then they aren't going to do as well as they could. When we look across the world, really, what we find is that the leading cause of death for children globally is preterm birth. If we look at the leading killers of newborn babies, there are three leading killers: preterm birth, injury during labor and delivery, and infection. And so when we began to look at what does it take to either treat or prevent those three causes of death, which together account for 85% of newborn deaths, it's actually not a very long list of technologies. I was kind of surprised. I thought maybe it's going to be 200 things.
Right.
But it turned out to only be 17.
Hmm.
And what you need is you need to be able to keep babies warm. You need to help them breathe if they are struggling to breathe. If they have jaundice, you need to be able to diagnose that and treat it with phototherapy. You need to be able to monitor their vital signs, and you need to do some basic laboratory tests to know if they have infection, if they're hypoglycemic, and be able to deliver fluids and medications. It's not a very long list of tools.
No, it's not. And that takes us to the proposal that you have made to the MacArthur Foundation 100 and Change competition, and you call it NEST. NEST. What does that stand for?
NEST stands for Newborn Essential Solutions and Technologies. And what it means really is that package of care that we know is necessary for good outcomes for newborn babies. And, you know, there's nothing new or particularly innovative about it. We've known how to identify, treat, and prevent these conditions for decades, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's we haven't had the technologies that can withstand these environments. And I think really a comprehensive approach to demonstrate what can happen when you put all that together in terms of improving outcomes.
Are there advantages from, let's say, a development and commercial perspective of bundling all these technologies together?
Yeah, you know, absolutely there are advantages. And one of the things that we've learned as we began to commercialize the CPAP device is both, you know, what's possible when you make it available on the commercial market, but also what are the challenges of trying to introduce a commercially available technology and distribute that in a setting where you just don't have the ready distribution networks that you would in a place like the United States. And we think that a package of Nest technologies to fully equip a district hospital that serves a community of about 250,000 people, we think ballpark that cost is on the order of $20,000. And if you multiply what's the market size all across sub-Saharan Africa for that, you're looking at roughly a $35 million market. That isn't the kind of market that is going to bring venture capital out.
Right.
It's not the size of market that's going to get multinational med tech saying, wow, we really need to go after that. And so if you're trying to subsidize essentially the cost of distribution across only one technology, quickly you take what could have been an affordable technology and you turn it into what's actually not an affordable technology. And so in having this bundle of technologies, it allows us then to spread that cost of distribution across the whole package to really make it possible to go in and meet these needs and do it in a way that is both scalable and sustainable.
Yep, real economies of scale there. And as part of this proposal, Rebecca, you're also looking to create an in-country education program. Share with us your thinking around that.
Yeah, so that's probably my favorite part of the whole effort. One of the things that has really, I would say, transformed engineering education at Rice is we built a facility here called the Engineering Design Kitchen. And it used to be an old kitchen. And it got converted into an engineering design studio that is full of all sorts of rapid prototyping tools, so laser cutters and 3D printers and hand tools and a PCB mill and all sorts of spare parts, resistors, motors, fasteners. And it's really designed to reduce that activation energy barrier for students who are trying to make a prototype and quickly do that and put their ideas into practice. And we have used that so extensively in helping our students design new technologies to meet needs in nurseries in places like Malawi. Well, in Malawi, right across the street from Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital, there's an engineering school called Malawi Polytechnic. The dean of engineering is one of our collaborators, a really wonderful woman named Teresa Makondawira. And she came to Rice and she saw our engineering design studio. And together we decided that we wanted to build exactly the same kind of engineering design studio at Malawi Polytechnic. And we've just done that. We did it with support from the Lemelson Foundation. And in the same way that it transformed engineering education here, it has completely transformed engineering education at Malawi Polytechnic. Students now have access to hands-on tools, and they are working to solve problems that come right across the street from them at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital. Every time I go to Malawi, my favorite thing to do is go visit that engineering design studio because it is just hopping with energy. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you've done that so many innovators in the West often fail to do is that you really have embedded yourself into the community of Malawi, and you have a true spirit of co-creation. And boy, this has really helped inform your work, I bet.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we've learned the most from is building student teams that are multi-institutional. So every summer we have students who come from Malawi Tech to Houston, and they work together with Rice students here over the summer. And we do exactly the same in Malawi. And it's been really interesting to see how much they have to teach each other. So I'll give you an example. The Rice students, you know, they've grown up with high-speed internet and unlimited access to information. And that's not true for the students in Malawi. And so, you know, often one of the first things the Rice students will do when they're given a problem is they'll go to Dr. Google and try and, you know, find information that will be helpful. And the Malawian students really needed help to learn how to make use of that kind of information in a setting where information was so widely and freely accessible. In contrast, when our students go to Malawi, you know, they just can't get online and order whatever they want from Amazon and it's here the next day, or go to DigiKey and order whatever they want. And so they were working with the Malawian students to come up with a way to improve a suction machine. And they wanted an IR light and an IR sensor to incorporate in their design. And the Rice students were like, oh, we can't get it on Amazon. Like, we're stuck. We don't know what to do. And the Malawian students were, they said, hey, we're just going to go down to Game. We're going to buy a TV remote control, and we're going to have both of those things. And you know, so they're much better at figuring out, how do you take what you have in your environment and turn it into a solution? And when you get that kind of thinking together, it's so powerful for the team, and it's just awesome to watch.
What have been some of the keys that you've been able to do this? You have created a work environment and a corporate culture that really leads to this kind of collaboration and innovative thinking. What is the secret sauce in having done that?
You know, I tell my students all the time that innovation begins with listening, because I think if you don't listen, you don't really understand what are the challenges that, you know, users, nurses, physicians, what are the challenges that they face when they're trying to provide the best possible care for their patients? And so you need to start with listening and keep listening all the way through, because it's easy to fall in love with your solution. And, you know, you think it's wonderful when maybe it doesn't really meet the needs. Users don't think it's going to help them solve their problem. And, you know, you can be depressed by that, or you can just confront that reality and keep going and then try and make it better. And so I think that building teams and building physical spaces that are permeated with that idea, I think has really helped us be able to bring people together and to move quickly and hopefully make a difference at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's a great point you make. And it's so true. We're never finished listening. I think a lot of us do it up front and think we've listened, but it never ends and it never stops. Well, if you should be so fortunate to be declared the winner of the 100 and Change competition later this year, Rebecca, what would the $100 million mean to this initiative, and how would you use it?
It would mean so much to really being able to address the challenge of preventable newborn death. You know, every year in Africa, more than 1 million newborns die, and these deaths can be prevented. And it's really, I think, time to do something about it. And I think this $100 million would mean a giant step toward solving that problem in a way that can be sustained. What we would do with the resources would be to scale up NEST all across Malawi. And we would do the same in southern Tanzania. And there we would rigorously evaluate what is the impact, what is the cost, and what is the cost effectiveness. And that data will be absolutely essential to drive uptake for this concept by WHO, by UNICEF, by other large NGOs that are engaged deeply in newborn care in Africa. And we would go to Nigeria to test the business models for being able to deliver and distribute these technologies, to identify and optimize novel ways of financing them. But I think most importantly, what we would do is we would expand this vision of engineering education from Malawi to Tanzania and to Nigeria, because I think the most important legacy of this will be that next generation of innovators that will take on the challenges of maternal care, the challenges of surgery, the challenges of care for chronic diseases, and really be that engine of innovation to keep this process going.
Let me close with this, Rebecca. Each of the 100 and change semifinalists, boy, you guys have so much respect for one another, and all of these are truly worthy and extraordinary proposals. But if I were to ask you, and I am, to make the case as to why Nest, the network of essential solutions and technologies, will have the greatest impact to address one of the world's most urgent problems, what would that case be?
Yeah, you know, I have to say we are just so honored and humbled to be part of an amazing group of eight teams, all of whom are taking on really significant challenges. I think in many ways for me, the challenge that our team is taking on really is the most important challenge facing the African continent. And the reason I believe that is if we look at history, history shows us that saving newborns is the most powerful key to initiating economic development in poor countries. Now, if we look at data from countries across the world, what we see is that when families have more confidence that their babies will live, that's when they choose to have fewer children.
Mm-hmm.
And families who have fewer children, they have more resources to invest in each of their kids. They're more likely to keep their kids in school, especially their daughters. And as fertility rates fall, then each working adult has fewer dependents to support, and you get economic expansion. And so I think that accelerating the progress to improve newborn survival, it's at the heart of how do we jumpstart economic progress there.
Well, Dr. Rebecca Richards-Cordham, founder and co-director of Rice University's 360-degree Institute for Global Health, I want to thank you so much for sharing this exceptional undertaking with us this evening. Now, for those listening who are interested in learning more about this work, where can they go to find that information?
You can go to rice360.rice.edu.
Well, great. Thanks, Rebecca. And my very best to you and your colleagues in the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change competition.
Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
With nearly one in four New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides tens of thousands of women across our city with the loan capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
And this evening's semifinalist of the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change initiative is Sesame Workshop, teamed together with the International Rescue Committee to educate children displaced by conflict and persecution. And here to discuss the proposal with us is Sherry Weston, Executive Vice President of Global Impact and Philanthropy for Sesame Workshop, and Sarah Smith, the Senior Director of Education at the International Rescue Committee. My thanks to both of you for being here this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let me start with you, Sarah. Give us an idea of the scope of the refugee crisis and that of displaced persons as it stands today, and how many of those are children?
Thank you. The scope of the refugee crisis today is unprecedented. There are 65 million people displaced around the world. Half of those are children, and under eights are about 12 million. So it's a massive, massive scale.
Mm-hmm. And if you would, for a moment, what's the difference, because we hear it used somewhat interchangeably, between a refugee, a migrant, a displaced person? What's the distinction among them?
The most important difference is that a refugee is somebody who has had to flee their country. So they've crossed an international border, and they have done so because they are in fear of persecution, and they're fleeing for their lives. A displaced person is somebody who has also had to flee their home, but they have not crossed an international border. So they have stayed within their country, but they've also had to flee because they are in fear for their lives.
Mm-hmm. And whether you're a displaced person or a refugee, how long on average do you remain, well, displaced?
It's quite shocking. I think this is one of the most unbelievable statistics. And on average, a refugee stays a refugee for 17 years, and somebody who's been displaced in their country for 25 years. So this is a long-term problem.
Yeah, this is not a short-term solution. Then this is their life. This is their way of life for a quarter of a century in some cases. Sherry, what's the impact on of violence and neglect and these unimaginable hardships on children and their ultimate development?
Well, Denver, you know, there's been so much research and evidence in the last few years on how detrimental those adverse childhood experiences, what is often referred to as toxic stress, mm-hmm. is on a child's development, with long-term repercussions to their health, not just to their cognitive ability, but to their health, to their livelihood. And so we know that if we reach children in those critical early years, that we can make a huge difference on children's outcomes, particularly for children who have been subject to violence or trauma, because they need the help to mitigate the damage from that experience. So when you think of refugee children, you know, obviously these are children who have had extreme experiences that can really alter their long-term opportunities. And this is an area we know we can make a difference.
Yeah. Well, Sherry, if you look at the totality of this worldwide humanitarian system, what kind of emphasis is placed on early childhood development, emotional well-being, and education?
Well, look, there's incredible actors in the humanitarian space that do amazing work. International Rescue Committee, you know, at the top of that list. But understandably, it's focused first on safety and on rescuing, on providing that shelter that is needed and the basics, nutrition, health. That is understandable. But that's always been because you're responding to a crisis. As Sarah said, when you now look at in the refugee space, how long families and children are displaced, when you're talking about not a short-term response, but a very long-term situation, it's understandable why the efforts have been where they were. But we really need to be focusing on education if we're going to give these children an opportunity. And that's only about 2% of all of the resources in the humanitarian space is focused on education. Again, you can understand why it's gone where it has, but we need to shift how we're responding to these crises as these crises have changed in terms of their sort of longevity.
Yeah, absolutely. It's time for a new way of thinking, no question. You know, speaking about the International Rescue Committee being at the very top of the list, how did this partnership between Sesame Workshop and the International Rescue Committee come about, and what do you do to kind of nurture and grow and develop that relationship?
Well, you know, you have to understand at Sesame Workshop, I mean, you're familiar with our work, but we always look at the world through the lens of a child, and we look at issues that how can we help children tackle difficult issues, whether that's HIV and AIDS in South Africa or girls' education in Afghanistan, autism here at home. That's something we do. So when we saw the staggering number of children displaced, we felt we had to do something. And we work with a lot of wonderful organizations in this space, and we'll continue to do so. But we were very thoughtful about looking at each one of those organizations, looking at their capacity, their expertise, their skills, and comparing that sort of with ours, which led us to the IRC.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at their experience on the ground, their infrastructure, their knowledge of refugees, and then you combine that with our approach to reaching children in those early years, our proven educational content, we felt like this was the right organization to partner with. And that led to a partnership long before the MacArthur Prize was even, you know, in existence. But we did feel like it was a marriage of strengths, that we complemented one another, and we formed a partnership that we announced about a year ago at the World Humanitarian Summit to just say this is something where we feel we can make a difference, and we were going to focus on the Syrian response region.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do make a remarkable team. So with regard to that proposal to the MacArthur Foundation, Sarah, what countries are you going to be focusing on, and what ages of children will this effort be directed toward?
Our program will reach children inside Syria and also in Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. And we'll be reaching refugee children and also vulnerable children in communities where refugees are living inside Jordan and Lebanon and Iraq. And we're focused on children who are under 8 years old. The youngest, as Sherry said, are the ones that need immediate investment.
Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of a refugee camp, I think, is pretty abstract and amorphous to many, many Americans. I know you recently returned from one of those facilities in Jordan. Describe to us, you know, what's it like on a day-to-day basis, and particularly for children who are there?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the hardest things to imagine as a parent is living in a place that's not your home and knowing that you have very few resources and opportunities to take care of your children. And day in, day out, that's what it is like for these families and these children. One of the most commonly misunderstood facts about this crisis and the refugees living throughout the region is that most of them are not living in camps, in a traditional camp setting.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are living in tented settlements and in shelters that are temporary, but they're scattered throughout these countries. Many are also living in vacant buildings. I was in Iraq last year, and it's astonishing how many families have taken up homes in buildings that were half constructed because they're places where they could find shelter. So the conditions are extremely difficult. Parents often have to either work long hours, leaving their children home by themselves or with other children to take care of them, or they're searching for work, mm-hmm. really struggling day by day to put food on the table and to take care of their kids. These kids don't often have access to education. Very, very few have access to preschools. So day in, day out, they're often home by themselves, either in one of these settlements or in a temporary place where they're living.
Oh, wow. You know, Sherry, you plan to provide a suite of programming and multimedia content. What are some of the things you're imagining and looking at and developing currently?
Well, you know, we've had a long history of creating local indigenous programming in the Middle East, in Jordan,
yep.
with Hikyat Simpson, Egypt, Alam Simpson. We currently have a broadcast out of the Gulf. It's Ifdaya Simpson. So what we always do is look to create something that's truly local, that's reflective of those children's reality, that is in their language and their culture. And we believe children respond to seeing themselves, to being able to identify. So one of the things we'll do is we will look to create an entirely new program, if you will, that would reflect their reality with new Muppets that are indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
And people think of Sesame Street as television. That will certainly be a component. We can reach so many children and their families in host communities through broadcast, through mobile. You know, it's no longer just television when we're reaching children and families. So that will be a component, but that will not be the only aspect, because we have enormous opportunity to create content that is engaging, that appeals to both the adult as well as the child, that is also used by the IRC and others in that space with much more direct interventions, whether
mm-hmm.
that's on a cell phone, whether it's for a classroom, whether it's through text messages. There's so many ways we can use our engaging content to reach those children and their parents, which is so important to reach the caregivers as well.
Yeah, well, you have a rich history in this part of the world
we
and
do,
are
we
going
do.
In quite familiar
and,
with...
And it's amazing, you know, traveling around the world, these characters have this ability to engage children in every place on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And even in those camps, when you think of that, maybe Zaatari as a bleak, when we bring in our characters and you see Elmo and these children light up, and the thought that you're going to reach them with quality, proven educational content, but at the same time, we bring a joy.
Yeah, a little bit of happiness.
And a hope. And that's really important in these settings.
I recall from your last appearance on the show how Sesame Workshops is dedicated and committed to formative research and testing. What are you doing in that regard in connection with this exceptional undertaking?
Well, I have to say it's another reason that we chose to work with the IRC on this initiative, because they have the same sort of importance. They have the same emphasis on quality research, evaluation, measurement. And we want that to be one of the deliverables.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we will test what we're doing. We do formative research to make sure that it's going to resonate, that it's going to appeal, that we have the right distribution platforms. We also test everything we do. Are we achieving the outcomes we set out to achieve with children, with their caregivers? And we want to share that. We want to share that with everyone. There is not a lot of proven evidence on what's most effective for children in crisis. And for us to be able to add to that body of evidence so that other players, whether it's in the Syrian area or Africa or beyond, can benefit from our learning, that's one of the hopes that the model that we can create can be replicated elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you're doing is you do have a pilot going on, correct?
We do.
A 15-month pilot. Why don't you guys speak to that?
Well, we were very fortunate. When we announced our partnership a year ago, we were able to secure funding from the Bernard Van Leer Foundation and Open Societies Foundations. And through generous support from both, we have begun a pilot phase. And where we start our testing, we bring together advisors. We've had that both in New York and in the region. And that allows us to create new content, test some content that we have now to see what resonates. And it's terrific. I actually think that most likely was a factor in MacArthur selecting us because we had secured funding initially. We were in the process of testing and learning. And I'm sure that was a big help in this process.
You know, it's difficult, Sarah, for me to imagine how you would go about distributing this content. So it ultimately reaches those 12 million children that you mentioned between 0 and 8, that audience that you're targeting. How do you plan on going about that?
Yes, indeed it is. It's challenging, but for us, I think, quite straightforward in many ways. We operate in every sector in the humanitarian system. So what that means is we have programs in health, in child protection, in education. We deliver cash to families. And because we work in all of those sectors and throughout the humanitarian system, we see that as our distribution platform.
Mm-hmm.
We touch families in every aspect of their life. So this program will deliver this educational content and these proven educational resources through this vast network of service providers, whether it's a community health worker who's going into a home to help a mother who's just had a baby, or whether it's a volunteer preschool teacher who is teaching a preschool class in a community center, or a child protection officer or a women's protection officer who holds group sessions with mothers and children. We'll provide for them the content they need to deliver those services, and we'll also push those resources into homes through this vast network of service providers. And I should say we also have excellent relationships with ministries of education and health, and we've heard from them that they are doing an amazing job of reaching refugees who've entered their countries but don't have the resources they need to deliver services as well as they'd like. And so for them, this is equally exciting to be able to have new content that they can trust and rely on and that can fit easily into their system.
Great. Let's turn to the 100 and Change initiative for a moment, if we could, Sarah. If your proposal, this proposal, is selected as the winning submission come December, and you should be awarded that $100 million, how would you go about using those funds?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, we would be able to deliver immediately. So if we are so lucky as to be selected, I think one of the most important things to remember is we are in the midst of a crisis, and we want to get educational resources to children and their parents immediately. Because we have this infrastructure and because we have such excellent proven content and Sesame's experience in the region, we have resources we can draw on immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll begin to deploy that content and bring these resources to children and their families starting right from the beginning. I think what Sherry mentioned about how we will, over the course of the 5-year project, not only bring these educational resources to children, we'll also demonstrate for the humanitarian system how this can be done. In addition to education being under-resourced in these contexts, the humanitarian system has been set up in a very fragmented way by sectors. So you have a health sector, you have a protection sector, you have an education sector, and they very rarely operate together. And what we'll show the system is how you can provide a coherent package of resources that can be deployed across those sectors and delivered within that system so that future crises, other actors can use this kind of model and it will transform the entire humanitarian system.
A template. Mm-hmm. Let me close with this for both of you, and I'll start with Sherry. There are seven other bold and exceptionally well thought out proposals amongst the other semifinalists, all addressing an urgent social problem. So what would be the case that you would make as to why this submission by Sesame Workshop and the International Rescue Committee will have the greatest meaningful and long-lasting impact on global society?
Well, first of all, I want to say that those other seven are incredible programs, and we really wish they would award eight winners. But I do believe that the issue we are addressing is the greatest humanitarian crisis of our time. And looking at that through the lens of a child, to me, is something that we know we can make a difference in the long-term outcomes if we're reaching children early. Without that, there's an entire generation at risk. And that has repercussions not just to their future, but to a more peaceful, stable world for all children. We also know that if you can reach children early, you can have an impact, proven impact, of giving them the tools they need to overcome these significant challenges and have the greatest chance to not only survive, but thrive. And if we can change the system, not just for the children that we will be reaching through this program, but so that there is a model. I'm sad to say it. I don't think that we're going to cure the refugee crisis. There will be future crisis and more displaced children and families in the future. But what we are proposing is something that could make a difference for all of those future crises. And I believe that it has a benefit to all of society.
That would be the long-lasting part. What would you add to that, Sarah?
Just to say that this is something, too, that I think bringing it back to children and parents. Parents that we have met with in Jordan just a couple weeks ago, these mothers are desperate for help and support. And I think any parent knows that if you can't support and help your child, you do feel completely hopeless. And they're asking us, and it's really on us to decide if we're going to answer them and deliver something for them or turn our backs on them.
Well, Sherry Weston, the Executive Vice President of Global Impact and Philanthropy for Sesame Workshop, and Sarah Smith, the Senior Director of Education at the International Rescue Committee, I want to thank you both so much for being here this evening and for such an interesting discussion. Sherry, if people are interested in learning more about this initiative, where can they go to find that information?
They can go to sesameworkshop.org/refugees, and they will see all about the partnership between the International Rescue Committee and Sesame Workshop and our work in this region.
Great. Well, my best wishes to the both of you and your colleagues in the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change initiative. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of the Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And this evening, we're going to take you down to Arlington, Virginia, and to the offices of the Navy Marine Corps Relief Society. What they do is help provide financial, educational, and need-based assistance to active duty and retired Marines and sailors, their families, and survivors. So let's find out why the people who work there like it so much.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about how the organization really makes you feel like you're a part of a family. I actually went away for 12 years and came back, so I'm kind of a retread. And there are people who are here, who just recently retired, who have been some of my closest friends ever and continue to be, as well as a lot of new people who just, you know, I knew coming back and re-interviewing that the people that were gone, you know, sure, where they were missed, but that the new people coming on board had been taken in and been made a part of the collective. So it was great.
When I got here, it felt so comfortable. The idea only entered my mind once about moving, and then I actually rationalized to myself, what in the world would you ever want to do that for? Because I enjoyed what I was doing so much. I knew I wasn't going to be able to go to another job and get that same kind of fulfillment. So for me, the feeling was immediate, and I still felt close to the military, being, you know, working with the Navy and the Marines, and still felt like I was doing something and giving back to that those groups. So that's what it was for me.
We're very volunteer oriented. We're big on recognition, volunteer recognition. That whole volunteer week is very special here for obvious reasons. So I think that's part of the culture of just giving back and serving. So that's reflected in how employees are as well. You'll see people who really are passionate about what they do. How can I help? You know, even if it means, you know, always going the extra mile. You don't want to, of course, burn out, but you see people who really care enough and they want to find a solution because we're dealing with tough problems.
One thing that is specific to society that you probably wouldn't know unless you worked here, and I thought was interesting when I came here, was our saying of spend what you need and not a penny more. I always found that saying perfect when you're dealing with donor dollars and how you have to tell people to get the job done so you can support the clients and the service members, but also not to spend too much and be responsible with the funds that we get.
And then I'm just going to touch on one thing where it says here, you know, when a new employee really belongs, I'm going to have to say it's the Christmas ornament. That if you're a new employee and Christmas time comes around, you get to place your Christmas ornament on the tree. But years go by, and each Christmas we still, you may not be here, you may have been retired, you may have moved, but each Christmas you still are here because your ornament still is here.
To me, the WOW is our visiting nurse program. We're the only military aid society that offers home visits by registered nurses, be that with a new mom and baby or our combat injured and their families. So that allows the clients that we work with to have that financial side of the house with the Navy and Marine Corps Relief Society, but then we also bring in the nursing piece to address all the other issues that they may have going on, be it access to medical care or other resources that they may need.
But I had more volunteers that actually said they wanted to come in than I had space where I could plug them in. And I just was thinking, wow, I mean, it's a weekend, it's a Sunday. I can't believe that I have more people raising their hand to come in and help than, you know, than I can even plug in. I mean, and that's just the kind of people that are attracted to the society and why I feel so lucky that every day I'm around people that really have a servant heart and want to give back and help people. So just being surrounded by people like that every day naturally makes the culture just a nice place to be because you work with great people every day.
I wanted to just touch upon how management trusts its employees with decisions like when we're in disaster mode. They give us, there's a group of people, we sit there and we handle all the decisions that need to be made. We don't have to worry about going as high up as we can go. We work as a team to make sure that the field is supported and we make sure that they have what they need so they can do their job helping service members that are in disaster situations.
I'm considered an area trainer and developer, so I get to be in both worlds. I get to be here at headquarters and work with a fabulous team and the divisions that we have. But then I also am able to go out to the field and be in awe of our volunteers and everything that they accomplish with sometimes just one employee and the rest of them just take it and run, and we try to evaluate what would improve their environment and their opportunities, whether it's training or communication, and then take all that data and bring it back and then reach out to those that can make changes and make differences.
I find something amazing about the society is that we have always at headquarters had Friday was casual work day, casual day. You didn't have to wear work clothes. And in the past, very often, people at headquarters seemed to take that a little far. But then we started really paying attention to branding, and Shelley came in, and it amazes me how many people on Friday choose to wear their branded shirts, because it has now become an organizational thing that we're proud. You know, we put on our branded shirts on Friday, and instead of wearing a T-shirt like we could, we now wear a branded shirt because we're part of the team and we are proud of that. And I find it very interesting that that has
evolved
mm-hmm. right into what Friday is now. Instead of being casual Friday, it's now branded.
Wear
your branded shirt. Right.
Yeah.
And yet we're proud of that.
Yeah.
We all are on board with that. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that's amazing.
I want to thank Shelley Marshall for organizing my visit and to all those who participated in this piece. Kim Zamagni, Josie Militello, Monica Woods, Wayne Osborne, Susan White, Tammy Akis, Brian Brookbank, Winnie Ursini, Holly Robertson, and Talisha Woods. To listen to this again, read the transcript, as well as see pictures of the participants and the offices of the Navy Marine Corps Relief Society, all you need to do is go to denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.